From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. President Bush has nominated Harriet Myers to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court. Myers is currently the White House counsel. President Bush knows her well, but she's never been a judge, and there's little information about her judicial philosophy. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the nomination with constitutional scholar and law professor Cass Sunstein. Also, we talk with film director David Cronenberg. He often makes movies that intentionally make viewers uncomfortable. His films include Scanners, Dead Ringers, The Dead Zone, The Fly, and Naked Lunch. His new film, A History of Violence, asks whether some people are inherently violent and whether they can change. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, President Bush nominated White House counsel Harriet Myers to replace Sandra Day O'Connor in the Supreme Court. If ratified, Myers would be the third woman to serve on the Supreme Court. She's also served in the Bush administration as assistant to the president, staff secretary, and deputy chief of staff. When he was governor, Bush appointed her chairwoman of the Texas Lottery Commission. In 1996, Myers became the first female head of her law firm, which then had about 200 lawyers. Earlier today, we called Cass Sunstein, a professor of law and political science at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk on the Supreme Court and has written extensively on issues of constitutional law. Sunstein's new book is called Radicals in Robes: Why Extreme Right-Wing Courts Are Wrong for America. Myers has never been a judge, and very little is known about her judicial philosophy and her positions on the controversial constitutional issues of our time. I asked Sunstein if it's unusual to have so little information on a nominee.
What makes this nomination really quite unusual is that in at least the last 20 years and probably more, we either know that the nominee is very qualified in terms of sheer ability, or we know something about the nominee's orientation to constitutional law, or both. This is doubly a stealth candidate. It's someone who doesn't have the record of demonstrated excellence that many recent appointees have had, including Chief Justice Roberts. And it's also someone who has a thinner record in terms of the great issues of the day than anyone really in memory. She hasn't been a judge, and so there isn't judicial product to evaluate, and that distinguishes her from most of the recent appointments. Not only that, she hasn't had Supreme Court experience, at least nothing substantial, so we don't know if she's experienced in the kind of litigation with which she'll have to deal. And also, she doesn't have any academic work that might show that she's thought in a sustained way about constitutional law. We do know she worked for a number of years on the Texas Lottery Commission, but that's not maybe the best background for the position of Supreme Court Justice. So there are a lot of gaps in her record compared to the recent appointees, which suggests she has a great deal to learn.
Now, it's interesting. The president must know where she stands on a lot of issues because she works so closely with him.
Yeah, the fact that this has been a White House counsel, the president's personal lawyer, and someone who hasn't spoken publicly in any capacity on the most controversial legal issues really gives the White House a terrific advantage over the American public in terms of knowledge of where she stands.
And what does that mean, that they have the advantage over the American public knowledge of where she stands?
Yeah, it means that Democratic evaluation, and by Democratic I mean small d rather than capital D, is very difficult. So both conservatives and liberals should be puzzled by this, meaning puzzled about where the candidate stands on legal issues. So the advantage that the White House has over really everybody else is that no one can tell from the existing record where this person stands on issues of constitutional philosophy. So it would be surprising if conservatives are dancing in the streets with joy at this appointment. This is not someone who has a demonstrated record of conservatism. It would also be surprising if liberals are breathing a sigh of relief, or if liberals are lamenting it because they just don't have enough of a record to know what to go on.
Some Democrats felt that John Roberts didn't have enough of a clear track record on the most important judicial issues and constitutional issues of our time. And he managed to get through the hearings and get confirmed without directly addressing several of those main issues. So if you look at how the Roberts confirmation played out, and then try to extrapolate from that to the Myers confirmation, what do you see in terms of the ability of Democrats or Republicans to elicit from her where she stands on issues?
The Democrats and Republicans actually learned a lot about Chief Justice Roberts. They read his opinions, and there were over 50 opinions for them to read, and they could tell from the opinions that he is meticulous, careful, someone who doesn't have his ideology in the forefront. So his judicial opinions were judicious, and that told them something. They also had, the Democrats and the Republicans, an extended record in which he talked a fair bit about constitutional issues. He also was forthcoming, more forthcoming than might have been expected, on some key matters. He said he believed there was a general right of privacy in the Constitution. He disassociated himself from the Scalia-Thomas view that the Constitution means exactly what the ratifiers believed it meant. He suggested a kind of moderation with respect to precedent that made at least some Democrats comfortable. So there was a record there, not as extensive as in the case of Judge Bork or Justice Ginsburg, but there was a record there. What makes this case quite different is there isn't the kind of public documentation that Judge Roberts had, and there isn't the kind of comfort that could come from reading a set of opinions, as Judge Roberts had, that showed this is a quite judicious person. Also, we shouldn't underrate, in the Roberts case, the powerful impact of sheer excellence. So a number of Democrats, as well as most Republicans, and many millions of Americans could tell this is someone who really knows what he's doing. To read Judge Roberts was to see this is someone with a first-rate mind. To hear him is to see this is someone with a first-rate mind. Now, it may be that Ms. Myers is similarly excellent, but she doesn't have the kind of background that demonstrates that excellence that Judge Roberts had.
What are some of the first questions you'd want to ask if you were on the Judiciary Committee?
Well, there's such a gap there. I think the first question to ask is, do you believe the Constitution means what it meant at the time it was ratified? To see whether she has that view associated with Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia. A second question is to ask, do you believe that there's a general right of privacy in the Constitution? I think a third set of questions would have to do with the president's power in domestic and international affairs. Many people were concerned about Judge Roberts that he'd had such extensive experience in the executive branch that in connection with the war on terror, in issues involving internal security, Judge Roberts would bend a bit in the president's favor. And that made members of Congress of both parties nervous, not just with respect to privacy, but also with respect to separation of powers. Ms. Myers has similarly had executive branch experience and more recently close to the sitting president. So the nervousness might be that on executive power, she would be very pro-president. You'd want to ask a bunch of questions about that. But we have to keep in mind with any confirmation hearing, there's a limit to how much you can really learn because the person is so well-schooled and is really running, in a sense, for the office. So with Judge Roberts, it wasn't just that he performed sensationally well in the hearings. It's also that as judge, there was a record of both excellence and meticulousness that provides some assurance. So you do want to ask her a bunch of questions about privacy, constitutional method, the power of the president, some questions maybe about equality too. But it's not clear that they can get enough from that to make a full evaluation, even if she's reasonably forthcoming, because she doesn't have a public record to study.
Right after President Bush announced her nomination, Harriet Myers spoke briefly, and in her comment she said, "It is the responsibility of every generation to be true to the founders' vision of the proper role of the courts in our society." Do you read anything into that?
Yeah, that's a problem. I mean, the view that the founders should be followed in all particulars, that's a red flag. The founders believed in slavery. At least the Constitution accepted slavery. The founders certainly permitted awful forms of race and sex discrimination. They had a much narrower view of free speech and freedom of religion than we now do. The founders didn't apply the Constitution to state governments at all. Now, I'm sure she understands that the Constitution was amended, most important after the Civil War, in a way that greatly expanded our rights. But if the Civil War amendments are considered a second founding, as some people consider them, then even since then, we've expanded our rights. The founders of the Civil War amendments, that is the people responsible for them, didn't intend to ban sex discrimination, and our Constitution now bans sex discrimination. And there's a good argument that they didn't intend to separate church and state with respect to states. That is, there's a good argument that in 1900 or 1890, Utah could establish an official religion, and so too for Massachusetts or Illinois or California. But we've gone beyond that through interpretation. So our tradition has been faithful to the text of the Constitution, but not faithful always to the particular views of the people who produce that text. And that's good. So when she talks about the founder's vision, she seems to be speaking of a constitutional approach that has been discredited. It's not clear that she endorses that approach to constitutional interpretation. That is the view that we should go into a time machine and ask what the founder specifically thought. But she does need to be asked about that.
Harriet Miers' work in the past few years has been working with President Bush in the White House in one capacity or another. Can President Bush and Harriet Miers invoke the attorney-client privilege to say, well, no, we cannot turn over any of her papers since she started working in the White House?
No question. The president can invoke attorney-client privilege. In fact, he can go further than that. He can invoke executive privilege, which is constitutionally protected, to say that his private communications with his lawyer are something that no one has a right to. So the president stands on very strong ground in saying that this is not material that should be made public, if that's what the president chooses to say. Now, any privilege can be waived. So if the president thinks some documents, at least, I want to make public as a way of giving some sense of what this person is like, the president can certainly do that. So insofar as the president wants to maintain confidentiality with legal advice from his own lawyer, he is on the firmest possible ground. On the other hand, members of the Senate can say, if we don't have that, we just don't have enough to go on. So they can say, in a way that is respectful of the president's constitutional prerogatives, we can't vote for her unless we see more. Now, it's possible that her quite interesting background in Texas and her recent work in the White House, combined with her dedication to public service, will convince many or most that there's enough there. This is obviously a dedicated public servant, someone who has devoted her life to thinking about law in multiple domains, and some people will think that's enough. But without demonstrated evidence that says something about her views of constitutional law, other people will be very nervous.
Cass Sunstein, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Cass Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Radicals in Robes, Why Extreme Right-Wing Courts Are Wrong for America. Coming up, director David Cronenberg talks about his new film, A History of Violence. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director David Cronenberg. His movies include Scanners, The Dead Zone, Videodrome, a remake of The Fly, Dead Ringers, and Naked Lunch. Cronenberg's new film, A History of Violence, asks whether some people are inherently violent and whether they can change. The film stars Viggo Mortensen as Tom Stahl, a husband, father, and owner of a diner in a small town in Indiana. He becomes a hero when he kills two armed robbers who are threatening the lives of everyone in the diner. Soon after, a mysterious man with a scarred face shows up at the diner and claims that Tom isn't who he says he is. The mysterious man is played by Ed Harris.
Well, welcome to Stahl's. Would you gentlemen like some coffee?
You're the hero.
I don't know, sir.
You're the big hero. Sure took care of those two bad men.
Really don't like talking about it, sir. We're trying to get back to normal here. So can I offer you gentlemen some coffee?
Sure. Give me some coffee. Make it black.
Yes, sir.
Joey.
And your friends?
They don't drink coffee. He doesn't agree with them. Joey.
Who's Joey?
You are.
My name's Tom, sir.
Of course it is.
David Cronenberg, welcome back to Fresh Air. A history
Thanks.
Of violence is basically saying that everyone, or at least most people, have the potential to be violent, but some people are forced to become violent to fight a bully, whereas others just seem to have a taste for it. Do you believe that most people do have that potential?
Well, I think it's innate in us, just genetically, that we are capable of violence. But in specific cases, you have to go on a case-by-case basis, but I think in the movie, we're really it really examining the ambivalent attitude that people have towards violence. It's, you know, you sort of don't want it to come and visit you in your house, but on the other hand, you might find it rather exhilarating when you see it visited on other people, either in the movies or alive. So it's the movie is a meditation on that ambivalence rather than, you know, saying anything very specific about genetics, let's say.
Well, you know, talking about that ambivalence about violence, I think movies themselves reflect that because violent movies are incredibly popular. People seem to like violent scenes in movies. At the same time, there's always these kind of attempts to crack down against violence in movies and, you know, fear that violence in movies will lead to violence in real life. How does that whole infatuation with violence in movies, how did that affect your style of shooting the violent sequences?
Well, rather than having an overarching theory of where violence in cinema should go or shouldn't go, or even thinking about my old movies and what people expect from me or don't expect from me, getting rid of all that, I think only about what is in this movie. And in it I say, okay, where does the violence come from? Well, it comes from specific characters. What does the violence mean to those characters? Where did they learn to be violent? That's really was the ruling factor in deciding how to portray it. And I came to the conclusion that for these people, I'm quoting a line from the movie, business would come first. It's business for them. It's a criminal enterprise. It's not sadistic pleasure. It's not ballet. It's not aesthetics. It's not martial arts. It's business. Get it over with. Get it done. If you have to kill somebody or hurt somebody, you do it as efficiently as possible. And normally using techniques that you've learned on the street. You know, you haven't been trained professionally, you haven't been in the army or anything like that. So that was the tone that I gave to the violence in the movie. And it's very intimate, the theory being that when you want to kill someone, you get close to them. You don't get far away from them. You actually get as close to them as you can. So the violence in the movie is very, very short and quick and realistic, no slow motion, no multiple cuts and so on. And it's very strangely intimate and very physical.
What did you have to learn about guns and fighting in order to direct the film?
Well, I really started only learning about guns through movies because in Canada, you know, we have very strict gun laws, gun control laws, and I actually never held a pistol in my hand until I was making a movie, actually. And in terms of killing on the street, well, I did find a couple of DVDs on the internet that purport to teach you how to do exactly that, you know, how to kill somebody with your bare hands if you're attacked, mugged, robbed. And that was also one of the places where I found that sense of intimacy with the person that you're trying to kill. The whole idea of those was that you move into the person. You don't step away so that they can shoot you or stab you or whatever. You actually get close to them so that you can touch them, feel them, smell them, see their sweat, see their pores. And from that vantage point, you actually are much more capable of inflicting damage and surprise on an attacker than you would think.
Was it kind of creepy to be watching this DVD about how to kill someone?
Well, it's presented in a very matter-of-fact, pragmatic kind of way, you know, with a great patina of professionalism and so on. There wasn't just one, it was several. And so it kind of decreases the creepiness. It's sort of...
The presumption is you're the innocent victim who's
learning
how to kill in self-defense, and you're a good guy. No bad guys are watching this DVD.
That's right, and you're getting... And you're seeing testimonials from old-age pensioners in Miami, you know, who are saying, I feel much more secure walking down the street now that I know I can kill, you know? So it kind of takes the sinisterness out of it, which in a way makes it even more sinister, I suppose. And, of course, I have no idea whether I could ever do that based on what I saw or not, you know? I mean, and certainly one hopes never to have to figure that out.
Now, A History of Violence is, it's kind of like a Western, and in part because there's a character in it who has renounced violence but is forced back into it in the way that a lot of characters in Westerns have been, like Johnny Guitar, you know, the guy who gives up guns but has to pick them up again because of threats against him and someone mm-hmm. he loves. Was your style of shooting this movie inspired by Westerns?
Not really the style, but certainly one of the things that attracted me to the project was that kind of iconic Americana tone that there is. And it's not just Westerns, but gangster movies as well. And it's kind of, you know, America's mythology of itself, which it has very successfully exported to the rest of the world through its movies and its art and so on. The man standing alone with a gun, protecting himself and his family against the bad guys and taking vengeance and having that be very justified because of what he is. And taking the law into his own hands is another very American theme, which is not particularly obvious in other countries, including Canada. You know, the idea that you, at a certain moment of crisis, you must take the law into your own hands, that sense of individualism and righteousness, the righteousness of the individual is foreign to many countries, most countries, I would say.
David Cronenberg directed the new film A History of Violence. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delacorte Press, publisher of Robert's Ridge, A Story of Courage and Sacrifice on Taker Gar Mountain, Afghanistan, by Malcolm McPherson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with David Cronenberg. His new film is called A History of Violence. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is film director David Cronenberg. He first became known for horror films such as Rabid, Scanners, The Dead Zone, and a remake of The Fly. As David Thompson wrote, horror for Cronenberg is not a game or a meal ticket. His subject is the intensity of human frailty and decay. In short, the body and its many accelerated mutations, whether out of disease, anger, dread, or hope. Cronenberg's new film is called A History of Violence. It stars Viggo Mortensen and Maria Bello. There's two sex scenes in A History of Violence that are both very passionate. And one of them is kind of playful and about role-playing, and the other is much more in anger and in violence, but still very, very passionate. Actors, and both scenes reveal a lot about the characters. Actors are always talking about how difficult it is to perform the sex scenes and how self-conscious they are and uncomfortable. What about directing scenes like that? What are the challenges in directing them?
Well, the vulnerability, both physically and psychologically, of actors in a sex scene is probably pretty obvious to most people. But there is the same thing going on with the director. You know, if a director is very sexually inhibited or repressed or shy or embarrassed or anything else, it inevitably is communicated to the crew and to the actors, and it makes them be the same. And therefore, you don't get a very good scene, probably. So it's really a matter of being funny, being loose, being specific, giving the actors the sense that you know what you're doing. In my case, I make sure that the actors can look at a monitor and see the recordings of what they just shot at any moment, so they know exactly what they look like and what's going on. No secrets, no surprises to hit them later. And it's just being very gentle and supportive, you know, and still, of course, getting what we want, but never letting go until we've got what we want. There's a scene on the stairs, sex on the stairs, very hard wooden stairs between Vigo and Maria Bello, and that was physically very difficult too, because she was really, they were both actually quite battered and bruised after that, because it took a day and a half to shoot that, and those were real wooden stairs. And at one point I asked my stunt coordinator if he had stunt pads, and he said he'd never been asked for stunt pads for a sex scene before, but in fact we couldn't use them because you know, you'd see them, so they had to do them without them. But yeah, I think it is a challenge. I think some directors are very inhibited, and you can tell. It gets communicated.
Is it hard to not feel like, you know, you're a voyeur or a peeping Tom when you're setting up a scene like that?
You are totally a voyeur and a peeping Tom, and it's better if you just admit it. You know, that I mean, you because at that point you are the audience as well, and you are watching. You're watching sex. I mean, it's not real sex, but you're watching a simulation of sex. So this is something, once again, that is joked about on my set. I mean, we all are in on the joke. There's no, you know, nobody who's not. So all of those aspects of it are out in the open, and there's no, you know, nothing's covered up.
Are these the most passionate sex scenes that you've ever done, as opposed to sex scenes that are about the potential for contagion?
No, I mean, I think that there was a wonderful scene between Jeremy Irons and Genevieve Bujold in The Dead Ringers.
Oh,
example.
Sure.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. was pretty passionate and mm-hmm. pretty, you know, intense. So I've done that before. It's just, but each scene, of course, is unique. And, for example, the cheerleader scene, as we call it, the role-playing scene where Maria dresses up as a cheerleader, and the idea is that they're going to create a past for themselves that they never had, as because they were not teenagers together. He came to town later. Of course, it does have resonances for the whole theme of identity and role playing and so on in the movie. So it's not just a sex scene for a sex. It really pleases me that the only two sex scenes in the movie, take place between a couple who have been married for 20 years and have two kids, you know, because certainly in American movies, it's like adolescent sex or forget it. You know, it's like if you're married, your sex life is gone, not worth filming.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Cronenberg, and he directed the new film, A History of Violence. I really liked the opening shot of the movie. When I saw it, I thought, oh, this is going to be good. And in the opening shot, two guys are walking out the door of a motel room, and they're walking into bright sunlight, and they really have to squint. The sunlight really hits them. And you can tell that they've come from a world that's like really dark into this bright light. And and you figure there's something really dark about these guys, and there certainly is. Can you talk about what you try to do in an opening shot to establish the tone, the mood? Because how important do you think that opening shot is?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This movie, I don't have an opening title sequence that's separate from the movie, and I've often talked about my enjoying doing that, that is to say making a title sequence that isn't a scene from the movie so that people are not put in the position of reading titles and watching the movie at the same time, and using that title sequence as a kind of vestibule, you know, to kind of ease the audience into the movie from being in their own world, and using that title sequence to set a tone that will set them up for the movie. In this case, I shot that scene, and it's a single shot that lasts for 4 minutes and is quite complex little shot with dollying and craning and a few other things. Not for spectacle, it's quite tight and intimate, but it does go through some very difficult little moments. And there's a kind of strange, languidly sinister tone to these two guys, and they take their time talking, and I don't rush them. And a lot of space between the words and so on. And I really like that tone so much that even though I did shoot coverage for it, which is to say did other close-ups and so on so that I could tighten the scene or whatever by cutting into it, I thought that the single shot worked so well that way that I would leave it and not cut into it. And at that point I thought, well, here's a perfect opening scene that I think I could put titles over in a way that I haven't done for many, many years. And then, therefore, this shot would have to do two things. It would have to be the first scene in the movie, and it would have to have that vestibule effect that I normally use a title sequence to get. That is, it would be a scene that would tell the audience a lot about what they were getting into with this movie. and interestingly enough, too, there's no music over this shot, which is also, I think, rather rare these days. Howard Shore, the composer, he composed some pieces to try over this opening scene, and whatever we did, it gave too much away. It pointed in a direction, and the scene itself is so kind of sinisterly directionless that it was actually better to have no music there. So it turned out to be, I think, quite an important shot and quite important sequence for the movie, because it does set up really an awful lot the more you think about it.
My guest is director David Cronenberg. His new film is called A History of Violence. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Cronenberg. His films include Scanners, The Fly, The Dead Zone, Dead Ringers, Naked Lunch, and Crash. His new film is called A History of Violence. You've written some of the movies you've directed, but A History of Violence is an adaptation of a graphic novel. You were approached with the screen adaptation of the graphic novel and decided to direct the film. Is there a difference for you in how you approach material that you've written as opposed to approaching material that you have not? And I'm wondering, in a way, if you feel freer to take liberties with either of the two.
No, I feel free to take liberties with everything. You know, I mean, to me, that's what I have to do. My first adaptation that was The Dead Zone, an adaptation of a Stephen King bestseller. And before that, all of the movies I had made, I'd written myself. They were original screenplays. And I felt that I immediately became obvious to me that in order to be faithful to that book, I had to betray the book. In other words, there is no way of translating a book to the screen, because the two media are so completely different. There is no dictionary for that translation. You know, you really have to reinvent it totally for the screen. And what you do is you try to capture the ambience, you know, this tone of the book, rather than be faithful literally, because if you try to do it literally faithfully, you're doomed to failure. So taking liberties with adapted material was as necessary as when you've written it yourself.
I'm glad you mentioned The Dead Zone. This starred Christopher Walken as somebody who, when he touches someone, he can see their future. And this was relatively early in Walken's career. And since then, you know, a lot of comics and impressionists have affectionately mocked his very strange pattern of speaking where accents fall on very unlikely words within sentences. Were you aware of that when you were directing him, and did that throw you at all?
No, I mean, I think it's a brilliant performance. He had won an Oscar at that point.
For The Deer Hunter,
mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a fine actor.
Oh, and yeah, he's great.
Yeah, you know, but every actor has a specific kind of rhythm and diction, and you develop a relationship in the editing room with the actor that's a unique relationship. Nobody has that relationship other than a director who's editing an actor, because you live with that diction for, well, weeks or months that you're editing the movie. And you become so attuned to that. I mean, for example, Jeff Goldblum also has some very unique and specific speech patterns that are not like anybody else's, you know, and you have to deal with that when you're editing. How much do you go with it? How much do you try to force it into a more familiar rhythm and so on?
Can you think of an example, either with Christopher Walken or with Jeff Goldblum, about how those rhythms made you need to make a difficult decision, how it was unpredictable and it threw you?
No, never. I mean, it's always it would delight me and surprise me.
Oh, how about an example of how it delighted you then?
When Chris wakes up from his coma in the dead zone, and they tell him that he's been gone for 5 years. He says, 5 years. You know, I didn't really capture it. I haven't listened to it for quite a few years, but there was just a wonderful, the surprise, you know, the shock and the horror of it all was expressed just in those two words, and it was the rhythm between the two words, just having two words to work with, that expressed that. And it was, you know, it was just fantastic.
You've made a lot of films with very dark and potent fantasies in them, and I want to quote something that you've said. You've said, As an artist, one is not a citizen of society. An artist is bound to explore every aspect of human experience, the darkest concerns. You cannot worry about what the structure of your own particular segment of society considers bad behavior or good behavior. You have no social responsibility whatsoever. First of all, do you still agree with that?
Absolutely, I do.
Why do you think it's important for an artist to not be inhibited when it comes to exploring the darkest parts of their imagination?
Well, society does not tend to encourage people to tell the truth. Society is, in general, is interested in sustaining itself, and that includes whatever fictions, so you are not encouraged really to tell the truth. You're encouraged to be a good citizen in the bad sense, which is to say an obedient citizen, one who toes the line, one who sort of accepts the standards of society without question. And this is a natural thing. All societies have this kind of gyroscopic need to sustain themselves, maintain themselves, and that imparts a certain stability. But at the same time, if you only go with that, then you never get improvements, you never get corrections of injustices and so on. So you need the words of the rebels, the artists, the people who will not accept reality as it is presented, but figure that there's something else going on. There's some other things. I don't mean I'm not talking about conspiracy theories. I'm talking about looking for the truth about the way things work and how those things might be improved. So you need both forces, though. You know, for civilization, you need both of them. I mean, in the Freudian formula, civilization is repression. You know, repression of the most basic, base, primitive instincts. But you don't get civilization without a rebellion against repression as well, as in the Freudian formula that will come from the unconscious and dreams and so on.
So are you working under the premise that most people have very dark thoughts or fantasies that they wouldn't admit to in public, and that it's in part your job to talk about those things that people have, but they won't necessarily say that they do?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think if you imagine just taking anybody asleep and drilling a hole in their forehead and having their dreams projected onto a screen for a couple of thousand people as though it were an entertainment, what do you think you'd see from anybody? You know, I think you'd see some pretty, you'd see some boring stuff, but I think you'd see some amazing things as well, you know, perhaps quite shocking, and it would come from straight citizens of all kinds, you know, and it's all there.
A couple of your movies are almost about that, like Scanners in a way.
Yeah,
almost,
I mean,
operates on that principle.
Yeah, there is a hole drilled in a forehead in Scanners, and I suppose I've been taking that my metaphor that I just gave you from that.
So if we're operating on the premise that you've done a lot of scenes over the years that are about these dark places that we don't want to admit exist in our minds, which of those scenes has gotten the strongest reaction from viewers and has proved to be like most troubling to viewers? Mm.
Well, I think there's some scenes in Crash that really have disturbed a lot of people. That movie caused a lot of controversy in various countries, including this one. And
well, Crash is a movie about people who get turned on basically by car crashes in which they or other people are injured. And so
yeah, that it's but they're not exactly turned on. You know, they are and they aren't. It's really, don't forget, everybody in that sort of strange invented subculture has been in an accident, a sort of a life transforming accident. And it's almost as though in order to come to terms with the fact that they survived that and perhaps were deformed by that, that they have to relive it in a more controlled way. And they find that the only people they can relate to are other people who have undergone the same experience. So, you know, in a way, the movie is a metaphor for those people who undergo these life-shattering experiences, whether it's being comrades in arms in a war or whether it's people who have had to fight off the same disease as you have. Finding people who are, in a, as I say, almost a subculture, who are the only ones who can understand what you've gone through, and finding strange ways to relive that experience and so come to understand it.
And transform it so that it has a different meaning.
Yes, that's right.
Or
transform it so that it has any meaning, because you might think that the thing that struck you is meaningless. And we are creatures who do not like to feel that things are meaningless, and we are very prone to giving things meaning. Meaning really only comes from us in the universe. As far as I'm concerned, the only place that meaning comes from in the universe is the human mind. Without the human mind, there is no meaning in the universe, as far as I'm concerned. So we are the inventors of meaning, and we are the only consumers of it. I mean, your average bunny rabbit in the grass does not need meaning to exist, but we seem to need it.
My guest is director David Cronenberg. His new film is called A History of Violence. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is director David Cronenberg. His films include Scanners, The Fly, The Dead Zone, Dead Ringers, Naked Lunch, and Crash. His new film is called A History of Violence. You've done several horror films. I mean, they're not standard horror films, but they're like your take on horror films. And you've said that the horror in horror films is about the inevitability of death. Do you think your understanding of death and your way of addressing it has changed as you've gotten older?
Well, I think my understanding has gotten deeper and more profound. Yeah, I think so. I don't know that that really necessarily will change the way that I deal with death in films. I said very early on that I think as early as Scan, as I seem to recall saying to somebody, every time I kill somebody in my movie, I'm really rehearsing my own death, you know, or it's like a trial run to see how it would feel, to see how I would feel. And I think there's still some truth in that. You know, that's why I don't take death lightly in my films. It's always a very significant event.
Does it give you a sense of control to be directing a death scene? Because we really have no control over death. But as a director, for those moments, you do.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons that directors become directors and actors become actors. Imagine the sense of control you have as an actor to sort of die doing 10 takes in a movie and then you get up and you're still alive. You know, it gives you a feeling of some kind of immortality, even though you know it's a false sense, and it gives you a feeling that perhaps in some way you will be more prepared for your own death having rehearsed it so many times.
Now, I was reading a little bit about your father's death. He had what sounds like a horrible disease where the disease attacks the body's ability to process calcium and your bones become so thin and brittle that they could break just turning over in bed, which is what started happening to him. I don't know when your father died, but, you know, when I see your movie The Fly, I always think about how the body can betray you, because the Jeff Goldblum character who mixes his genes with the genes of a fly and starts to transform himself into a fly, his body starts to putrefy. And and it's a very disturbing movie because of that.
Yeah. Well, it's once again, it's like it's rehearsing, you know. At the time, people wanted that to very much represent AIDS, and they were sure that I was creating that as a metaphor for AIDS. And I said, well, really, it's more like a metaphor for aging and the kind of thing that everybody has to undergo. We all have this one disease, you know. It's called mortality. And we are absolutely doomed to play that out. So... but once again, I mean, that character starts to feel that he's not just dying, he's transforming, he's becoming something else. And of course, in a certain narrative sense in that movie, he really is becoming something else. But he's also transforming into an oblivion, let's say. And that's something that's very difficult for people to accept, you know, their non-existence. And so much of art and religion and politics has to do with evading that reality, to not have to accept one's own personal oblivion.
Are there scenes in movies that you saw when you were young that disturbed you, that you were afraid to go to sleep afterwards, or those images would kind of come up and bother you and you couldn't get rid of them?
Oh, sure. Bambi.
Bambi.
Terrifying.
With the fire?
Terrifying.
The fire?
Terrifying. Oh, and the death of the parents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Dumbo. You know, the scene where Dumbo is being separated from his mother. Because these are things that censors who are worried about what children can take and what they can't take seem never to understand, is that a child's perspective on things is quite different from an adult. And separation from the parents is one of the huge traumatic things that exists in a kid's mind. And so I can say that the original Blue Lagoon movie... not the Brooke Shields one, the one way earlier with John Hall. There were scenes in that. That was the movie that made me sleep with the lights on for a week. It's about a couple of kids who are on a boat. The boat catches fire and sinks, and the kids are the only ones left alive, and they swim to this nearby island, and they grow up in isolation on the island. But it's the fact that they're alone, you know, that their parents have died. That was the terrifying thing about that movie for me.
And did that contribute to you wanting to make movies? Being so...
I doubt it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I always thought I would be a writer, and I even at that early age, I thought that I would be a writer. And my father was a writer. I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. I used to fall asleep to the sound of his typewriter, you know. So, so it was a kind of a surprise when I found myself being a filmmaker. It was really not something I had ever anticipated, and it really didn't come to me until I was in university of Toronto. So it was relatively late in life compared with some of the Hollywood wunderkinds or whose fathers were in the film business and so on. So they had a lot of models for that, and I didn't have that. I had a model for writing, really.
David Cronenberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
David Cronenberg's new film is called A History of Violence. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Mike and Scott. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing with music from the soundtrack of A History of Violence, composed by Howard Shore.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from Scholastic, presenting the children's book Inkspell by Cornelia Funke at scholastic.com/Cornelia Funke. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A trial in Pennsylvania is testing whether intelligent design has a place in public school science classes. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Edward J. Larson. He's written extensively on the history of evolution and the continuing debate over science and religion. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book on the Scopes trial. Join us for the next Fresh Air.